My name is Jim Nichterlein, and the topic I want to look at today is the Marxist critique capitalism. Whatever one thinks of Karl Marx and Marx's philosophy, there can be no doubt as to his influence. Marx is, I think, arguably the most important political philosopher of the modern era. A good part of the world lives under socialism, and most socialisms in the world are derived directly or indirectly from Marx. So his influence there is obvious and doesn't need elaboration. And even that large part of the world which is non-Marxist, non-socialist, still has a good deal of Marxist influence obvious within it, including here in the United States and other parts of the West. Marxism is still alive, even though it is obviously, in the United States, by no means the dominant philosophy. In fact, perhaps the single most distinctive thing about American politics is that we do not have a socialist party of any significance. There are various little tiny socialist movements of one kind or another. But we are unique, the United States is unique, in that of all the industrialized societies of the world, it is the only one that does not have a significant socialist movement politically. There's no other country which that's true. And in a way, that goes against what Marx and Engels thought was going to be the case. One can find, Engels is Marx's collaborator, Friedrich Engels, one can find the writings of Marx and Engels in the 1870s and 80s, and then Engels later on after Marx died, a number of predictions, or at least estimates, that the socialist revolution, when it came, might very well come in the United States. This is for two reasons, why they were basically optimistic, Marx and Engels, about the progress of socialism in America. One is already by the 1870s, 80s, the United States was one of the leading industrial powers of the world, in which capitalism was reasonably fully developed. And of course, Marx, the late Marx, with his view of pattern of history, saw socialism finally as the product of the final culmination of capitalism. You couldn't get to socialism without going through capitalism. And so since America was in many ways the capitalist society par excellence, it seemed reasonable that socialism, when it arrived, might very well find itself arriving in the United States. Not only was America a highly developed capitalist society, but what was also significant to Marx is that it had gone through its process of industrialization in a rather compressed way. That is, the process of industrialization and capitalist development in the United States is similar in its broad outlines to its outlines anywhere in the world, in Western Europe. What's different about capitalist industrial development in America is that it was compressed in time. We went through our industrialization process and our development of large-scale capitalism in a relatively short time. Just one statistic will indicate that. As of 1850, the United States, in terms of industrial production, its gross national product, you might say, ranked fifth in the world, behind Britain, France, Germany, and Russia. By 1900, just 50 years, which is a very short time historically, we were number one in the world, and in many ways producing almost as much as these next four combined. So there'd been an incredibly compressed and rapid development of industrialization in America. And since Marx believed that socialism develops out of the contradictions of capitalism, out of certain tendencies within the system, there was some hope in Marx and Engels that because the process of capitalist development had been so telescoped in America, the contradictions might reveal themselves the more rapidly, and so the revolution might come the sooner. Now, of course, it didn't work out that way. And as I say, the United States is unique now, not because we are socialist, but because we have no significant socialist movement. There is now more of a Marxist intellectual influence in America than there has been in the past. But still, Marxism is very much a minority movement. But still, it's one that has influence among intellectuals. And since intellectuals set the agenda, it has influence anyway. There's a great dispute among Marxists as to who's the true Marx. It's rather like the Marxist body of writings are rather like Christian scripture. There are certain clear things there that anyone who calls himself a Christian has to believe. There are certain things about Marxism that anyone who calls himself a Marxist more or less has to believe. But there are great variations. As there are many branches of Christianity, there are many branches of Marxism. And today, in to put it in simple outline terms, the controversy as to who's the true Marx, even as what is the true Christianity, is between what's called the young Marx and the late Marx. The young Marx, predominantly from a manuscript written when he was only 26 years old, born in 1818, and he wrote a volume, or he had a body of writings called the Economic and Philosophic Manuscripts, were finished in 1844. And it's from this that you get the young Marx. And then it's later on in, well, a whole range of works, Communist Manifesto, Das Kapital, and many other things, you get the mature or late Marx. In terms of distinguishing between the two, the simplest sort of shorthand term we use is that the young Marx is often can be seen as a humanist Marx, whereas it's the late Marx that is seen as the more Marx the scientist, Marx who had discovered in his own eyes the laws of history, learned how history moved, what its patterns were, and what its outcome was to be. Today, I would say, in the West, it is the young Marx who is most admired as the young Marx who is the model for Marxist analysis. There are a number of reasons for this. One of them is that the scientific Marx, at least so far, hasn't panned out. That is, capitalism has not, because of its internal contradictions, destroyed itself. Capitalism, in fact, is flourishing, much more so in many ways than it was even in Marx's era. And it seems much more stable than it did then. So Marx, as predictor of history, is somewhat under a cloud. Though, of course, it always has to be said, in his defense, the fact that the revolution hasn't come yet doesn't mean it's not going to. The fact that capitalism has not destroyed itself through its internal contradictions doesn't mean it won't in the long run. There are still true believers of Marxism in the sense they still believe he did know what the laws of history were, that he had properly discerned its pattern, and that it's still going to happen. It's rather like, after all, if you're making an analogy with Christianity, the second coming hasn't come yet. And some people, after all, the early church thought it was imminent. Well, obviously, they were wrong. We don't say that means Christianity is wrong. We simply mean that the time frame has been expanded in terms of its ultimate realization. Well, so a Marxist can believe, but still, nonetheless, the fact is capitalism is relatively healthy, at least in the first world, and doesn't show imminent signs of collapse. So Marx, as predictor of history, is somewhat suspect. Secondly, the scientific Marxism is somewhat suspect because where it's been realized in places like the Soviet Union, the regimes that have been created are not very attractive to most Western critics. That is, even those who consider themselves Marxists, most Marxists will concede that the regimes that call themselves Marxist-Leninist have a lot of flaws, that they don't fulfill the Marxist dream. So Marxism has had some discrediting because of the history of the Soviet Union and other Marxist states. Yet Marxism remains very much alive, and especially the young Marx, because what it provides, even if Marx turns out not to be true as a predictor of history, he still has great force in producing a critique of capitalism. I think Marxism's greatest attraction today is not for the system that Marx said is going to be created. or not for an absolutely accurate prediction of how history is going to work. The continuing attraction of Marxism, it seems to me, is as a critique of capitalism. It's handy. It provides a way of understanding, of looking at Marxism, capitalism, from a critical perspective, and presenting at least potential alternatives. So among intellectuals in the West, and among communist dissenters in the East, Soviet Union and elsewhere, it is the young Marx that is most of interest and appeal. Marx the humanist versus Marx the scientist. I'll be talking more about that a bit later. There are one other preliminary comment. It seems to me there have been two periods in American history when the Marxist critique has been of greatest influence. The first, most obvious, was the 1930s. When the Great Depression hit and lasted, for many people, the Depression was the vindicator of Marx, because the Depression seemed to fulfill what Marx had said was going to be the end of capitalism, that was going to lead to ever greater recurring economic crises and finally collapse of the system. It has often struck me as a historian that the surprise in looking at American history of the 1930s, the surprise is not that there were a number of Marxists around, the surprise is that there weren't more. Because he seemed objectively, as I say, to be vindicated. Capitalism had collapsed, not just in America, worldwide. And so the economic critique of capitalism, from the late Marx now, seemed vindicated. And so Marxism was attractive as a mode of economic analysis. It purported to explain what had gone wrong, and it offered a way out. With the revival of capitalism, with the New Deal, and then beyond, that economic analysis of Marxism, that is the economic analysis of what's wrong with capitalism, receded. And in the 50s and early 60s, for a lot of reasons, including the Cold War with the Soviet Union, in which any kind of radicalism becomes suspect, Marxism very much recedes in the United States. It got a revival in the 1960s, and then stays alive to a degree in the 70s and 80s, though again, very much an intellectuals movement. But it got a revival now, not so much, the interesting thing about the revival of Marxism in the 60s and 70s is that it came not under conditions of economic collapse. There was no economic collapse in the 60s and 70s. Yet it was still, it seems to me, attractive because it was a critique of capitalism. But the critique now kind of shifts its ground from fundamentally an economic analysis, as it was in the 30s. Capitalism has failed, and here's why it's failed. Here are the laws of history that show it, why it's happening and what the future can be. In the 60s, rather, you get it seems to me, it's a fundamentally a moral critique of capitalism for which Marxism becomes useful. These are not mutually exclusive. That is, in the 30s, in making the economic critique of capitalism, people often also, of course, talked about its moral shortcomings. And in the 1960s, those making an essentially moral critique of capitalism also talked about its long-run economic weaknesses. But it does seem to me there's a fundamental shift in emphasis. And it's the Marx that is the basis for the critique of the 1960s is the young Marx. The Marx of the economic and philosophic manuscripts. People are interested in him, again, not so much because he's revealed the laws of history and history's end, but because he is handy and useful as a way of criticizing a system that people found unfulfilling. And now the problem was not that capitalism didn't work, but that it was dehumanizing. And the young Marx can be useful in explaining that. And perhaps, without any other preliminary comment, I'll just go on and start to talk about the young Marx, the humanist Marx. First of all, any questions or comments? Well, essentially, it's an interesting point. Marx, of course, was still living and writing while the railroad's effects should have been pretty obvious to him. But the other thing is, Marx would have said that the railroad will not in itself save capitalism. I mean, you may get more efficient modes of communication, but from Marx's point of view, the late Marx, there are internal contradictions. Doesn't make any difference what kind of communication system you have or distribution mode. There are contradictions within the system that nonetheless will bring its downfall. Marx would not have been, impressed with that.
Yeah, I guess an example of the kind of thing you're talking about is that, during the 30s, a guy like Reinhold Niebuhr was very attracted to some of Marx's critiques of capitalism, and yet in the early 50s, he was a big critic of Stalinist Russia. Mm-hmm. So, I think it illustrates the kind of shift you're talking about in the career of one person.
One person, that's right. That's right. There are a lot of intellectuals who were very attracted to Marxism, communism, socialism, one form or another, in the 30s, who later changed their mind for a variety of reasons. One, the revival, two, basically, the revival of capitalism. And secondly, I think the revelations of Stalinist Russia. It just was very disillusioning. Here was the great Marxist state, and it turns out the Marxist state was a barbarism. And that was a tremendous discreditor to socialism and to Marxism in the West. And then, as I said, with the Cold War, you got a lot of internal pressures against any kind of Marxist thought and analysis. Okay, if no other questions, then the young Marx, Marx the humanist. What distinguishes the young Marx from the late Marx? Basic outlines of the political philosophy are not really different. That is, it's not like there's some revolutionary change between young Marx and late Marx, that he totally changes his mind. Much of the analysis of capitalism and so on is much the same. The outlines of the late Marx are very clear in the early Marx. The difference is that the young Marx, the humanist Marx, is not really a determinist. There is far more room for human creativity in the young Marx than there is in the late Marx. In the late Marx, you almost get the impression, at least in times, depending on what text you're reading, that history is moved by great economic social forces in which individual human beings make virtually no difference. That is, history happens in spite of us. History is simply the product of great impersonal forces in which there is not much room or need for individual human creativity and activity, that we are simply products of vast forces over which we have no control. In the early Marx, there's far less of this kind of determinist view of history and of human development. And the young Marx, in the young Marx, you can see patterns of an essential autonomy of human life and thought. Men and women are creative beings who can change history as individuals. They are not simply products of large, great historical forces. Now, it's sometimes thought that another difference between the young Marx and the late Marx is that the young Marx is not a materialist and the late Marx is. That's not true. Marx was always a materialist. His view of life is essentially materialist. That is, but he's a materialist, the young Marx, but he's not mechanistic. What do I mean by materialist? Well, Marx says that the truth of the human situation can only be seen by viewing men and women in their material situation, that is, as producers of material goods. We become fully human. We creatively express ourselves. We realize ourselves. We fulfill ourselves in our work, in our labor. This is what we are meant to be anyway. We are, most importantly, producers of goods. But in the young Marx, while the most important thing about us is our material situation, that is, we are producers of goods, we are not a mere reflex of the productive system, of the productive process. In economic activity, the young Marx says, men and women fully express and realize themselves, and in effect create themselves. We are not simply the products of circumstance and environment in the young Marx. We are not simply creatures carried along by history. We have creative potential. We change circumstances. We can change life. We are not simply products of history. We are makers of history in a creative way. Now, perhaps the key element in the young Marxist philosophy is seeing man, generic man, as what Marx called a species being. S-P-E-C-I-E-S. And this man as species being is Marx's ideal picture of what man is meant to be of what men and women ought to be. To make that point more clear, we might say that, instead of using the term species being, we could say Marx sees man as a universal being or as a community being. That is, in the idea of man as species being is that man is a free and universal creature meant to live harmoniously and productively with nature, with other people, and thus with himself. That is, we are meant to be fulfilled whole creatures. We are meant to be people who feel at ease in the universe, who feel that we are at one with others and with the universe, that we are meant to be community, universal beings, working, as I say, productively with nature, with others, and with ourselves. That is what man is meant to be. But instead, what we experience in the present reality, Marx says, in fact, what we have experienced throughout all history, instead of this sense of wholeness, of being community beings, of living in peace and harmony and wholeness with our fellows, instead, our present reality is one of alienation. We don't live at one with nature, others, and with ourselves. We are, in fact, estranged from, separated from, feeling uneasy with our place in nature, not working productively and cooperatively with others, and not even feeling at peace with ourselves. Instead of being universal creatures, we are egoistic creatures. We are, Marx says, pure particulars. Instead of working cooperatively and harmoniously with our fellows, instead we are, he says, avaricious, competitive, seeking to dominate and to exploit others, and nature as well. We live in conditions not of harmony with others, but in conditions of egoistic isolation. And our work, which is meant to be a creative, the most creative expression and fulfillment of self, work is simply an external affair, something not intrinsic to us, and it exists as necessity. That is, we need our work under present conditions simply to satisfy our animal desires. We have to have work in order to eat. But our work is an alien thing. Our work is not something that is a creative expression of ourselves. It is a pure, brute, animal necessity. Now, in this alienated condition, Marx says, all that's left of our dream of ourselves as species being, as universal being, or as communal being, is expressed in religion. What we do is project what we ought to be, what this world is meant to be, what our lives in society are meant to be, onto God and onto eternity, the life beyond. So that religion, which to Marx is an illusion, what religion is an expression of our deepest desires and wishes. But instead, what makes religion an opiate of the masses for Marx is that it is used not as it ought to be to help give us a vision of what we ought to be, but it's used as a way of diverting our energies and our hopes and dreams for human fulfillment beyond present society to the future. So instead of creating a world in which our species being could be fully developed, in which we could become universal communal creatures, we simply say, oh, well, that is beyond possibility in this life. And we use all sorts of ways to explain that. Capitalism is in the nature of things. Human selfishness is in the nature of things. Given original sin or given our natural self-interest, life is simply going to be difficult, scarce, competitive, rather than harmonious, peaceful, cooperative. And so we say that's simply the nature of things, and we project then what we can be onto the life beyond. I was talking last week about how this is realized in certain versions of Lutheranism, that we simply assume, given human nature, we say, that life is meant to be dreary, and we are simply strangers and aliens in this miserable place, and we shall only fulfill ourselves beyond. I'm but a stranger here, heaven is my home. Earth is a desert drear, heaven is my home. Danger and sorrow stand round me on every hand. Heaven is my fatherland, heaven is my home. So that in Marx's terms, what we're doing there is diverting what should be revolutionary energies and visions for this world onto the life beyond. And this is what drove Marx, made Marx so furious with organized religion, the opium of the masses. Instead of becoming a spur to change and transformation, it becomes a way of justifying the lack of any change or transformation at all. Now, why is it, according to Marx, that alienation is the central reality of our existence? Why are men and women alienated from nature, each other, themselves, rather than living in harmony? Well, in simple terms, Marx says, it's because our relationship, well, put it a different way, because the mode of production, which is the basic institution of human life, has been organized not on universal grounds, but on particular grounds. That is, the relations of production, rather than encouraging the universal communal part of ourselves, instead are organized on particular private grounds. We don't have, since the most important thing about us is our relationship to the economic world and to modes of production and relations of production. To fulfill ourselves, therefore, to make men and women into species beings, the modes of production and relations of production have to be organized on a communal basis. Instead, they have always been, throughout history, organized on private bases. And so we are blocked from fulfilling ourselves. We are blocked from becoming universal creatures, because that which determines us, the economic system, is organized not on universal but on private, particular, individualistic bases. And this form of alienation, which it takes its most obvious form in private property rather than communal property, this form of alienation, which to some extent has existed throughout history, is at its most fully developed under capitalism. Our work becomes not a creative expression of self as it's meant to be. Labor becomes a brute necessity. It becomes a thing. We are not creative beings. Our work is bought and sold on the market. Our work, our labor, which is meant to be the fullest expression of ourselves, is a commodity. It's a thing. And so, in the most important part of our life, our work, our labor, becomes an essential element of our alienation. Another thing that stops us from being under capitalist conditions, stops us from being fully creative, fully realized human being, is that with the division of labor under advanced capitalism, most of us are reduced to a kind of meaningless role in the productive process. At least in simpler forms of society, one could have at least some form of true creativity. You take a piece of leather and you make a shoe. You have a sense of truly creating, producing something, and in that way, at least, expressing yourself. Under advanced capitalism, Marx says, we are reduced to being insignificant cogs in a vast productive process. So that our labor is meaningless, it's pointless. The great image of this, of course, is sitting on an assembly line. This is after Marx, but the equivalent, sitting on an assembly line, putting a screw into some machine and doing that all day long and never seeing our work as something truly creative and productive. And in capitalism, it's not just the workers who are damaged by this and prevented from becoming fully realized human beings. Capitalists themselves, Marx says, are non-persons. They're simply profit seekers. They have no concept of creative work. They also are involved in a competitive struggle that consumes them, and yet that they don't know how to get out of. And if things are bad for the capitalists, they're so much worse for the workers. The workers are degraded. They live under conditions of subsistence wages, barely able to stay alive, and Marx says that under capitalism, the working class will always be kept at a level of subsistence. They live under conditions of vast inequality. They are dominated by others. They are simply subordinates. They are unfree to be creative persons as they are meant to be. And what is needed, therefore, to end this alienation is the communal organization of human life to produce equality and cooperation. And if one can modes and relations of production away from private and individualist directions to communal directions, you will then have the key to ending human alienation. We will then be free to participate in our work as a communal, fruitful enterprise. Men and women will be restored in the Marxist vision to unity with nature, others, and self. As when the thing that defines us, our relationship to the means of production, is transformed, so we will be transformed. Now this, in very simple terms, is the outline Marx sets out in the Economic and Philosophic Manuscripts. And I think what's most attractive to many intellectuals, particularly today, in this whole vision, is this concept of alienation. Alienation is the great human problem, at least for modern men and women. As I say, the sense of separation from others, from nature, from self, the sense of not being at peace in the universe, lack of a sense of wholeness, of connectedness that all of us in some sense yearn for. And Marx gives an explanation for this. Marx says that alienation is the function of, the product of our economic arrangements. And alienation can be overcome. There is still the possibility for us to become species beings, universal beings, communal beings, by changing the economic arrangements under which we operate and which go farther than anything else to define who we are and what we are. Now, in this younger, the humanist Marx, there's not much talk of objective processes of history. There's not yet the great laws of history. Men and women are actors who can make a difference. We are not simply, you know, floating along on the great tides of the great forces that move history. We are movers and makers of history in the young Marx. Now, Marx himself, by the way, in this whole debate about the young Marx and the late Marx, Marx thought that what he had written young was young. It was immature. I mean, for Marx himself, the late Marx is the scientific Marx. And if he was going to be worried about the legacy he left, he would just soon have not have these earlier manuscripts around, because it's the late Marx who has uncovered the key to history. Because by understanding the processes by which history will move through this pattern he's talking about earlier. Any questions to this point? Yeah.
Well, it seems that we're describing Marx as a humanist. Yes, a humanist is basically a rejecter of God as an external force in a person's life. In other words, yeah, the human himself can evolve through his own actions. For me, at least, that's the major failure of Marx, is to accept that there is a God, and that, in fact, human improvement is impossible aside from God.
Yeah, a number of Christians on the left today use Marx in various ways in terms of certain kinds of analysis and critique of capitalism. But it seems to me there finally is a fundamental contradiction between Christianity and Marx's vision, Marxism, on this very grounds of alienation, which is central. It is central. I mean, finally, you know, Christian doctrine says we are alienated, not at peace with nature, others, and self because of sin. We are rebels against God. And that rebellion against God, that human pride, that separation from God, that sin, is what creates alienation. And there, finally, ultimately, that alienation is resolved only in the gospel of Christ and forgiveness. We must be restored to a right relationship to God, Christianity says, in order to end our alienation. And even then, that will only be perfectly consummated at the end time. I mean, here and now, we experience reconciliation. We get a sense of transcending alienation. We get a sense we are forgiven, we are restored to a right relationship with God, but of course in Christian terms there remains in us the old Adam. We are, as Luther says, at once sinners and saints. And so alienation can never entirely be resolved in history, from at least in traditional Christian thought. Alienation is not a product of our socioeconomic arrangement. That may contribute to it, it may make life worse. But finally, alienation is alienation is inherent to what we are, which is sinners.
But there's a sense in which Marx is very much in the Christian broad tradition, in the sense that he believed in the whole, and not like capitalism, the interaction of parts. He never believed that the parts were the real.
Mm-hmm.
The parts were always part of a whole movement of history.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a Christian notion.
Mm-hmm.
That capitalism is really anti-Christian in its fundamental assumption. The fundamental assumption of Christian is that we all belong to God, and everybody is a part of the whole, and you have to start with the whole. And that's Hegelian Marxism.
Yeah. Yeah.
So formally, Marx is more Christian than the capitalist ideology. So you have to be very careful with throwing around that because he didn't believe in God, he didn't believe in the whole. Where it seems to me that capitalism doesn't believe in the whole, and therefore is atheistic.
Well, you can argue the one part of that, but I don't see how you can make Marx Christian. I mean,
no, I agree with you on that. But you don't make him Christian, but philosophically, he's much closer to Christianity in terms of his broad philosophical position than is any individualism, which depends on the interaction of individuals simply for the good to emerge.
Well, we'll be talking about this more tomorrow, Christianity, capitalism, and socialism.
Be careful about throwing around this notion of God as really separating. Just because people say they don't believe in God, and people say they do believe in God, they may not believe in the substance of, or the philosophical implications of believing in God, even though they say they do.
Well, I can agree with you to the point where I'd say that there's a similarity between the vision of man fulfilled in Marxism and a vision of reconciled humanity and the way we live with one another in Christianity.
You hit the nail on the head. You're not going to fulfill man by changing the social conditions. That was his belief, and I think it's
important. Okay, yeah.
I think it was Paul Latour who wrote an essay on the religious significance of atheism. And one of the points he made that Marx was able to help, in this case Christians, see our social trappings.
Mm-hmm.
And what's left is, in my sense, the gospel. And not all social trappings. And in one sense, it's the trappings, it's the institutionalized religion that could be the opiate.
Mm-hmm.
Of the people, and he kind of laid this out in a real detailed way, but it gets back to the communal and back to some of these other sort of things that somehow we call all that religion, and Marx and other people have a way of cutting through all that and leaving raw the essence of the gospel.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wouldn't say the essence of the gospel, but
Marx doesn't tell us what the essence is. I'm not saying Marx does that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I guess, you know, in terms of the conversation we're having, if you think about when Marx was writing, you think about the Industrial Revolution in Europe and England, and you read about what conditions were like there, and you also read about where the church was taking its stand, it's not hard to understand how Marx could come to the conclusions that he came to about either conditions of human beings in industrial cities in Europe and England, or the conclusion he came to about religion as the opiate of the masses, because the church very much, you know, at that point, institutionally sided with against the working class, the rising working class at that point.
Also, the history of Russia and Peter the Great and the churches in Russia and what they did in the power up to Karl Marx, you can see why they hated the church. The church sucked all of the life and the money out of the people.
Mm-hmm.
And if I had lived in that and saw that, I would have hated the church too. And I think church and religion have something different to say in history than believing in God. I think so much of church history isn't God-related at all.
Well, certainly one could say that in many ways the institutional church of the 19th century acted as a reactionary or conservative force. But I think Marx's critique of Christianity goes a lot deeper than that of the institutional church and their social role it's playing.
Okay.
I mean, it finally is a different idea of humankind and what finally is the human problem, what finally is the human solution. There are certain, you know, you can see certain echoes or similarities of you know, that we are meant to be fulfilled, whole, cooperative creatures. And in that sense, there's a commonality of vision to some degree. But I think that there's a fundamental different understanding of what human life is about in Marx than there is in Christianity.
This is a minor point that might be impossible to answer since you're not Karl Marx, but when you use the word immense, when you describe that whole universal man and everything, who meant? Where did the meant come from? Did anybody ever question him on that? I mean, don't you presuppose a creator, a divine being, or some, you know, meant? Meant means mind, doesn't it? Think, design?
Well, I'm using that word, not Marx. What Marx would use it, Marx believes that history has a pattern. And in the broadest general sense, history moves from universal poverty to universal abundance. That is the pattern that he thought history in the large formed. And when I say man is meant, it is history has a movement, a teleological end. History is moving toward abundance and equally shared abundance. And it's under that equally shared abundance that then mankind, humankind, will be transformed into this whole non-alienated cooperative being. And in that sense, it's meant in terms of the fulfillment of...
A movement, but not the design.
Yeah, there's no... There's nobody... History is moving along by dialectical process.
Design without a designer.
That's right. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
I don't think I'm hearing you say that because as Christians we reject Marx's religious view that we would necessarily have to reject everything Marx said. I mean, can we borrow still our ideas from him?
Oh, certainly, and a lot of Christians do that, is in terms of, and that particularly is a critique of capitalism. That is, the great significance of Marx today is not so much in the Marxist-Leninist system, which, you know, not a lot of people believe in out in the West, but it's still powerful as a critique of capitalism. You can use Marxist analysis of class relations, class conflict, and so on, so that, in that sense, you know, a Christian can use certain forms of Marxist analysis, but it seems to me at the fundamental philosophical level, a Christian cannot fully be a Marxist. I don't see how it can.
I think that the statement that Marx believed that we lead from his problems to abundance, it was that his theory preordained the kind of behavior a man would have to reach that point. And I feel that, and then the discussion may be better tomorrow, but for the sake of the balance, that the response, in a sense, is already preordained to reach that particular level, where taking it from a Christian viewpoint is that it's an elicited response that is not preordained. In other words, it's the hope on the basis of the process and the freedom to make choices, that's the destination to reach.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where the theory falls apart, and instead of allowing the freeing of the individual, it captures him. And
well, of course, in Marx, Marxism, you're supposed to have the withering away of the state, and I mean, it's not just a condition of equality, but it's a condition of unity as well. Well, that's a certain stage. You could get into the question of Christian and predestination, and I'm not sure.
I don't want to use predestination, I guess I want to use that there is we start at a point of we are free to make choices, and unfortunately we make some bad choices. Rather than taking the theory and starting, I said, everyone will make the choices that I've agreed upon that will lead you to this response. I guess that's the...
Well, to say that there's some difference in the early Marx and late Marx, in which the early Marx there seems to be more of a creative role for individuals, and the late Marx, and again, it depends on what text you're reading. To simply say Marx is an economic determinist is too simple, because there are sections of his writing where he seems explicitly to repudiate economic determinism, and yet other parts where it's hard to read it any other way except as determinism. As I say, it's sort of like the Christian scriptures. It's like the Bible. You pick your text, and that's where you get your doctrine.
The gentleman behind me was raising the issue about the role of the individual, perhaps the suppression of the individual in the capitalist state, but it seems that the practice of Marxism as we find it in the modern communist states is to, again, suppress the individual completely, subservient to the state as the supreme authority. And I just want, we haven't mentioned that at all here yet as to how, you know, this idea of the supremacy of the state flows out of the philosophy of Marxism. And maybe it isn't. Maybe it flows out of Lenin, for example. I'm not sure. But I was just wondering if you could comment on where this idea of the supremacy of the state came about.
Well, yeah, I mean, how should I put it? The Marxist societies have not turned out the way Marx envisioned them being. That is, what a Marxist will say is one cannot reject the Marxist philosophy on the basis of the way the Soviet Union has turned out.
Or any other communist.
Well, to date. That is, pardon?
Or any society on the basis of its ideals. So the way you can't take its functioning to criticize its principles.
Yeah, what's useful in Marxism is the philosophy and the analysis. And that one can argue, can remain valid regardless of what has happened in the Soviet Union or anyplace else.
I'm sure Marx would have rejected Stalin completely.
Yeah, I would agree with that, definitely.
Marx would deny our church completely, too.
Well, yeah, you could say that. What I wanted to present here today was not, because we'll be talking tomorrow about capitalism, socialism, and Christianity. What I was interested in here is not a debate between the relative merits of capitalist states and non-capitalist states. What I'm simply trying to show is simply a very simple outline of the Marxist critique of capitalism. And as I say, that can stand on its own independent of history and independent of the reality of the Soviet Union or any other Marxist state. Now, one can argue there are elements in Marx that lead that way, or that there are a whole set of problems of power and so on that he was unaware of and didn't fully analyze in their socialist phase. But he certainly didn't intend the way things turned out. Any other questions or comments?
Do you get that in his writing, I've read enough of it, other than the manifesto and a few things, but Das Kapital a bit, but was he writing in a utopian sense, Plato or Huxley, was he in a utopian mood when he was sitting in his apartment in London?
Well, Marx has very harsh things to say about the utopian socialists, right, and about utopianism. Marx certainly, the quote, mature Marx, would have vehemently rejected the idea that this is a nowhere world that he was creating. I mean, he's talking about real historical patterns and real historical development, and this is not pie in the sky and we hope someday, or if everything were different, it would be this way. He sees real patterns of development leading that way. Sure.
Does it make sense to ask you, I think you probably got more to say, to ask you to go ahead with three or four basic elements? I'm struck by all the, none of the Marxists I know, people who call themselves Marxists, would say that much of the last conversation for the last 20 minutes was relevant to what they think they grab out of Marx's work to deal with capitalism.
In what ways?
That is, that you really haven't gone in to the elements of the critique that are applied to capitalist states.
Yeah.
And that's what people use these days, and that's what they talk about when they talk about themselves as Marxists.
Yes, the problem is, I've got...
Yes.
5 minutes. What I was going to do, the outline idea was the young Marx and then the later scientific Marx, and I really can't, because of, we've got, 3 minutes? I really can't get into the late Marx, except to, how briefly can you... put this. Marx says there are internal contradictions in advanced capitalism that inevitably build on each other and will necessarily result in its collapse. Fundamentally, the three great contradictions of capitalism, Marx says, is first of all, it moves to monopoly. that less that you move from competitive capitalism to monopoly capitalism. The lesser capitalists are extruded. They can't compete because they can't keep up with the technological change. They become part of the proletariat, which continuously expands. Secondly, you've got recurring crises of massive unemployment that result in the nature of the capitalist system, and they're going to get worse and worse. Partly because what the capitalists do as profit maximizers is to replace workers with technology, so that you get increasing patterns of unemployment, because you can, to increase your profit, you can only push your workers so far in terms of increasing their productivity. At a certain point, they die on you. So it's better to use machines. And so you have this massive unemployment. And the other value of this for Marxism is this reserve army of the unemployed helps keep wages low. And then the third element is the declining rate of profit in Marxism. That is decline of surplus value. That which is expropriated from the workers, I mean, the labor theory of value, in which all economic value comes from human labor. And what capitalism does is that the owner of the means of production expropriates the surplus value, that which should go to the worker, for himself. The problem is capitalism is productive, capitalism is progressive for Marx insofar as it contributes to the development of greater human productivity. Is the movement from universal poverty to universal abundance. Capitalists are very progressive for Marx in their great productive energies. But the problem is you get recurring crises in capitalism from the things I've mentioned, plus this fact that there's a declining rate of profit because capitalism winds up producing goods for which there are no buyers. It gets recurring crises of overproduction or underconsumption, however you want to put it, because it keeps workers at a subsistence level and you have unemployed. So that you've got these recurring crises that occur simply because you're producing goods over the long run for which there are no, there's no market. So then the capitalist stops being a progressive force because in order to solve the problem of declining profit, he cuts back on production. Capitalism succeeded feudalism because feudalism became a fetter, a limit on production. Capitalism knew how to expand production. What happens in the late stages of capitalism is the capitalists, to save their profit margins, in the short run, cut down on production, thus themselves become fetters on production. You've got the increasing immiseration of the working class because of growing unemployment, growing economic crises, keeping workers at subsistence wages, and finally, with these recurring crises, and with the help of the vanguard of the revolutionary class, the Communist Party, which helps reveal the contradictions in the system, which shows the workers their true condition, which strips away the false consciousness under which they've been operating, you finally get the revolution between the bourgeoisie and the proletariat, in which the proletariat, the expropriators are expropriated, finally, when the workers rise up, and thus you get the creation of the communist system. And then the state can wither away, or the state loses its purpose, because under capitalism, the function of the state, it's the executive arm of the ruling class. Its purpose is to hold down class struggle. History moves through class struggle, class conflict, and what happens in a sense with communism is you get the end of history, as we've noted, or in another sense, the beginning of history. This history has moved through class conflict. Class conflicts occur because people in society have differing relationships to the means of production. And so history moves to this constant dialectic of struggle between competing classes, classes that are defined by the relation of individuals to the means of production. Well, once communism comes, once the revolution, there's no longer any competition. So you have a classless society because all property is now communal. So the function of the state disappears because the function of the state was to rule in the interest of the ruling class and to suppress the rest. Well, in full communism, since there are no more class conflicts, by definition, there are no class conflicts, because there are no classes. Therefore, the dialectic of history stops. I mean, one of the criticisms that's made of Marxism is, why does he suddenly have the process stop moving? I mean, if there's always this dialectic, and he borrows this from Hegel, and there's not time to go into it, constant thesis, antithesis, synthesis, but at some point the whole dialectic stops. But he has an explanation for it stopping, because that which moved it is no longer there. And once then the revolution comes, once class struggle has stopped, then we can become the productive, cooperative, whole people we were meant to be. because I no longer, in order to fulfill myself, have to compete with you. And you don't have to compete with me. There's enough for the self-realization of all of us. And it's not that human nature isn't transformed in the sense that in the communist state the good part of us will overcome the bad part. But human nature at any given point is always a function of the economic arrangements. And change, if you transform the economic arrangements, you transform humanity. Marx totally rejected any idea of a fixed human nature. Human nature is a function or a reflection of the economic arrangements of society. And if you transform those arrangements, therefore you transform man without any inner struggle going on in humankind. It's just new arrangements, new people. And that is...
That's
the shortest.
Dan going through the Bible in 8 minutes.
Yeah, that's right.
You got to put it in the war too. The fact that with a declining income here and profits, we then seek profits abroad.
Yeah, Lenin develops this in which he says that we're looking for markets, we're looking for raw materials, and we keep exhausting it internally, so we expand out and out and out. So the imperialism, in that sense, is a late stage of capitalism. But finally, you can't keep delaying the final moment of accounting forever. That sooner or later, the contradictions will catch up.